Podcasting from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory in the high desert near Taos, New Mexico, this is the Deep Sage 9 One. Starcast.
Welcome to the Starcast for the week of July 27, 2025. I'm your host, Jay Schaefer, with my co-host, Mike Lewinsky. Let's look at space weather. I saw in the social media headlines today, it was that we have a big blob CME headed our way. So we're looking for possible aurora. Is that right, Mike?
Yeah, hi, Jay. I think that that big blob might be a little hyped. Spaceweather.com is calling it a minor CME that may produce a G1 class geomagnetic storm. And that's forecast today, July 27th. The official probability forecast for us in the mid-latitudes, 5% for the next 48 hours, chance of an active condition, which is the lowest level of geomagnetic storm. We also see in the next day a 30% chance of a minor storm and just a 10% chance of a severe storm in the next day. Of course, at the higher latitudes, they're up to something like a 65% chance of a severe storm. So the further north you are, the better your chance of seeing this so-called big blob CME.
Okay, so let me tell you what else is happening this week. As Wednesday on the 30th, we will see the peak of not one, but two meteor showers in the same evening. The Southern Delta Aquarids will be visible in toward the southern sky in the northern hemisphere, and the Alpha Capricornids will be toward the southeast in the northern hemisphere. The Aquarids usually show about 25 meteors per hour, and they're a pretty active meteor storm. And then the Capricornids usually show less activity, but may have slower moving and bigger fireballs. And so that's what we got, a couple meteor showers to look for this week. And of course, August is kind of the active month for meteor showers. And so we're going to look forward to some more meteor showers over the next couple weeks. In space news, our interstellar visitor is 3I/Atlas is still topping the headlines. Is the interstellar object an alien probe? Mike has the story. Mike?
Yeah, Jay, there is a lot of, again, hype in social media and in the news about a preprint paper by Harvard astronomer and astrophysicist Avi Loeb. He gained some fame during a previous interstellar object, the comet Oumuamua, that showed up in 2017, and he suggested that a very long cigar-shaped asteroid might actually be an interstellar probe by alien civilization. And, you know, he makes kind of some interesting points. There's, you know, and even in this new paper, they acknowledge that this is all very speculative, but there are 9 points in the new paper co-authored by Adam Hibbard and Adam Kroll. They suggest, for example, that the orbit of this new comet 3I/Atlas is unusually parallel. It's within 5 degrees of the ecliptic plane, and they calculate that the odds of that happening just, you know, randomly are around 0.2%. And a lot of these points that they've developed are really statistical. 3I/Atlas is going to approach three planets, Venus, Mars, and Jupiter, at a relatively close distance. And the cumulative chances of that happening is around 0.005%. As Avi Loeb and his co-authors argue, that this is the kind of pattern you would expect to see if this was a probe conducting a planetary survey. Now, it's notable that 3i/Atlas is going to avoid Earth. And when it is closest to the sun at perihelion, the object and Earth will be on opposite sides of the sun. And they speculate that, you know, if this is alien technology, this might be intentional to avoid Earth-based telescopes making detailed observations when it will be the brightest and most visible due to its proximity to the sun. But, you know, the rest of it is, it's just all pretty speculative. Those are the highlights, I think. You know, very low odds of it having the orbit that it has and making the passes that it has, and the rest of it just gets more speculative from there. So I think it's, you know, it's interesting. It's worth, you know, mentioning. It is being overhyped. You know, I've seen headlines like the aliens are coming, we're about to be visited, and there's really, you know, not enough evidence to make such a headline claim.
Yeah, I was saying that a couple of the things that they, this criteria that they would say would qualify a alien probe would be that it might have some kind of radio wave activity, not radioactivity in the sense of radiation, but that it might have radioactivity. And another thing that they would say that would be indicative of a alien probe would be that it would actually change orientation. In other words, so it might be like repositioning an antenna or something like that. And they haven't observed any of that kind of behavior.
Yeah, and you know, if the one of the speculation in the new paper is that there are two opportunities that this object will have if it had engines to perform an Oberth maneuver. For engines, by the way, this is this is the fastest object we have ever seen in our solar system. So it is moving at something like 152,000 miles per hour. Go back and find that. It is moving exceptionally fast. And so, but it could, 152,000 miles per hour. It could, if it had engines, fire those engines and stay in the solar system if it was say, programmed to do a more extensive reconnaissance. And obviously, if we see something, if this thing doesn't leave on schedule, we can be much more excited about the possibility that we're being visited. And excited could be positive or negative. It depends on a lot. If I was going to design a probe to visit a solar system that I thought was inhabited, and I wouldn't want it to be detected because it could be captured and I would lose the opportunity to get that data, possibly. I think I would design it in such a way that, you know, have the instruments make the near pass to the sun and collect the data, and then, you know, start transmission a year later, you know, when it's far, far away, and A, going to be less likely to be noticed transmitting, and B, even if it is noticed transmitting, especially traveling at that speed, you know, you're going to have some years to transmit your data before any earthbound ship could catch up to it to capture it, or, you know, if that was even possible. I'm, you know, at that speed, I'm not sure that, you know, if we detected it a year from now, transmitting signals, I'm not sure we could catch it with our technology. So, radio transmissions would be a dead giveaway, and maybe the aliens aren't as worried about it. Maybe they have a high burst transmission and they figure it's a one shot. They transmit everything in, you know, a matter of hours. And then if we take their probe, oh, well, it did its job.
Well, that's pretty interesting. I was trying to think about calculating what the percentage of light speed that the object is moving at, but I'll have to save that for when we're offline. But and of course, again, you know, you would say that, you know, if they had a radio transmission, that would only move at the speed of light. So at the very shortest time period, if it came from Proxima Centauri, the transmissions wouldn't reach their source until for another 25 years of our time.
Right.
So let's go on to our topic for today, which is how would a beginner get started with astrophotography? And so we'll talk about what equipment and techniques that you need as a, you know, budding astrophotographer, somebody that is just getting started with the hobby or the pursuit, and what advice that we can give them. So, Mike, what would your first advice be to somebody that wanted to get into astrophotography?
Well, we almost all have cell phones that are capable, if it's a modern cell phone, capable of taking long exposure photographs. And so, you know, the tool that you already have is sometimes the best tool to get started with. You can learn some of the, you know, the basic points that are so important for getting good pictures, even if the camera underperforms relative to expectations. And I would caution, you know, to have lower expectations of a cell phone camera than a dedicated DSLR. But, you know, those basics are, first of all, you absolutely have to have a way of keeping the camera as still as possible. So ideally, a tripod, and they do make small clamps that will hold on to a cell phone. I've got several of them. They're very inexpensive. They just screw onto the top of the tripod head, and you clamp your phone in, and then with that, having the controls still functional, you can go into the advanced manual settings of the camera. Just about all modern cell phone camera apps have a manual mode. And so then you can set an exposure time for a dark night. And I recommend starting out with as little moon as possible, starting out with a 15 to 30 second exposure. And, you know, don't be afraid to try different exposures and different values of the important settings. And the important settings for astrophotography are going to be, of course, that long exposure time, probably not less than 15 seconds, maybe 10 seconds for a really good DSLR, or even 5 for certain DSLRs. But for a cell phone camera, we're talking 15 seconds. Turn off night mode. It's not going to help you. You want to be in manual mode and set your exposure, maybe start at 30 seconds. Set manual focus. And this is going to be probably the hardest part for the beginner, is getting the stars focused. Your phone may have an infinity focus point, at which point you can try that. I found, you know, variable results. Not all infinity focuses are true infinity. And so start with, you know, the long distance focal points, and, you know, adjust up and down a little bit as you take photos. Setting ISO to probably 3200 is usually what we go for there. And, you know, use the higher resolution sensor if your camera has more than one. You want to figure out which one is the best and select that sensor / lens. I will also say the last point about this is that you probably want to enable either a timer function, so that you, when you press the shutter, it waits for 5 or 10 seconds before it takes the photo. Or almost every phone has a voice activated mode. And I'll just relate a little story that when I was in Yellowstone last year, I was taking photos, and I had my DSLR on a tripod, and it was using an intervalometer to automatically take pictures. And I was making time lapses, but I wanted to take some manually. And so I had my cell phone on its tripod, and I was using the voice activated feature. And there were other people out there. This is after dark, other people out there just kind of watching the eruption of Old Faithful. And And there I am sitting on a bench with two cameras. And every 30 seconds, I'm saying the trigger word, which was whiskey. So somebody who was walking along might have thought this was pretty strange. Here's this man who just periodically says whiskey. And he really needs a drink.
that's super funny. And yeah, and I of course I know that you are actually sober, so that makes it almost even funnier. And yeah, I wanted to comment on that a little bit. Is that tripods is probably the most important piece of photographic equipment that you can buy, no matter what kind of photography that you're doing. And and I always kind of joke is that you cannot walk into any thrift store anywhere in America without seeing two or three tripods for sale for under $10. So if you're short on money and you need to acquire a camera tripod, it was almost invariable that you'll find one in a thrift store. And I guess
Jerry, if I can just add on to that, I've got a carbon fiber tripod that's ultra light. It's perfect for backpacking or hiking. And it's my least favorite tripod. I almost never use it. I like the big, heavy, clunky, old steel, the heavier the better. I mean, of course, you can weight down a tripod, but I don't want it blowing over. I've had cameras damaged by being blown over. And so, you can spend a lot on a carbon fiber tripod, but I think for a beginner, getting something that's really solid and is probably very important.
That's definitely true. I have the same experience. I've got a carbon fiber and it's got the rotating locks on the legs, and I've had those slip, and so basically one leg goes down and then it dumps your camera. And so I've also had some bad experiences with that type of tripod. And like my cheapest, probably you're right, my cheapest tripod is the one that I use most often out there. And another thing, of course, is having a projective cover on your iPhone or your smartphone, so that should it get dumped, is that it will bounce. And that's always a piece of good advice. And a couple more things on smartphone astrophotography is there's actually there's a Facebook group that I'm a member of that's called Smartphone Astrophotography, and it's a great resource. And they talk about the Samsung S22 is a very capable phone for doing astrophotography. The Google Pixel 9 and now the iPhone 15, they all have astro modes specifically set for where you can use them to capture the Milky Way. And they're basically kind of tuned to do that. And they use stacking as well as long exposures. And you can also go into, like you said, the manual mode and get some really great results. And I'm actually seeing some pretty really spectacular results of Milky Way astrophotography, where you're actually seeing the color and the definition of the star clouds. And there was one post in particular I saw yesterday, and it was a person that had tried to do astrophotography for the very first time using a Samsung. I guess it was the Google Pixel 9. And they were in an urban environment, probably Bortle, 7. and they did their exposure, and they said, "I am amazed. I can only see three stars with my naked eye in the night sky." And when I took the astrophotograph with the Google Pixel 9, I suddenly realized that the sky is full of stars. And so, you and I have been doing this for quite a while, you know, we kind of take that for granted, and that experience, you know, we're used to experiencing lots of stars in the sky. And, you know, to me, that was very enlightening to see that, you know, the kind of wonder of somebody that is just experiencing that for the very first time, and being able to experience that through astrophotography.
Yeah, it's such a great way to extend our experience of the night sky. And I mean, I suppose I get a little spoiled sometimes when I look up and it's like, there's just not that many. And I'm in a very, you know, Bortle 1 environment, as you are, you know. So,
yeah. And so another thing, especially with smartphones, and is that you can do is something called digiscoping. And so digiscoping is where you basically put your phone up to the eyepiece of a spotting scope or binoculars or a telescope, or you can get these screw-on or clip-on telephoto lenses for your smartphone. And so that will greatly increase your focal length and decrease your field of view. And so, and those are the particularly appropriate if you want to do moon photography with a smartphone, is that, you know, a lot of people will see the full moon and just use their smartphone and try to use their the digital zoom in their smartphone, and they're not going to get really good results with photographing the moon. But if you can digiscope that with an inexpensive pair of binoculars, or, you know, again, if you can get binoculars that mount on a tripod, and then you can get the digiscope mount, which mounts the phone to the binoculars, you can get some really incredible results. And I mean, I've seen people doing deep space photography where they're astrophotography, where they're actually getting galaxies and nebula just using this digiscoping method. So that's kind of some of the things that you can do with a smartphone. What about if you have a DSLR or even a kind of, you know, point and shoot type of camera? How would you get started in astrophotography with one of those types of cameras, Mike?
Yeah, again, certainly having a tripod is absolutely essential. And having a manual mode is likewise really necessary. And I did a little research right before our call here to look at what the kind of entry level for astrophotography might be. And there seems to be a pretty good consensus that the Canon EOS Rebel T7 is probably a good place to start. That runs $530, and I see that across the internet from Best Buy to BH Photo to Amazon, all running at that point with an 18 to 55 millimeter lens. And that is an interchangeable lens camera. It's an APS-C sensor, so it's not a full frame, but that's plenty good to get started. And so a tripod and a $530 Rebel T7 is probably sufficient to start doing astrophotography, wide field astrophotography. Now, if you want to do deep space with a telescope, then, you know, the beginner level is probably running time, right? We're you know, the amount of money you'll spend to buy a telescope, buy a good mount and a digital camera, you know, is putting deep space astrophotography into the, you know, many thousands of dollars, probably, you know, $2,000 to $3,000 to start. Whereas wide field astrophotography, which is really my favorite, you can get into it for, let's call it, you know, $550 once you've bought that thrift store tripod.
Well, and of course you can get a actually used camera as well. And, you know, the T5, which is two versions back of the T7, is a camera that I've actually used in the past. And so you could probably get those for under $500. And so that's a good way to get started with doing that wide field. And again, let's talk about our settings a little bit. Is that we probably want to have a lens that is a 28 millimeter equivalent or wider. And so, you know, when we say a 28 millimeter equivalent, that means it would be a 28 millimeter lens on a full frame camera. And so on an APS-C camera, that might be a, that would probably be the, what, about a 20 millimeter or, you know, 18 millimeter lens for an APS-C type camera. And then again, with those manual settings, is that you would go on your mode dial and you'd want to go to the M setting, which is manual. And generally, like you said, we'd want to probably start with an exposure between 15 and 30 seconds and a iris at the course, the widest that you can possibly get it, you know, for whatever lens you might have. So if it's an F4 lens, for example, which most kit lenses are, that would be probably the widest that you could go with aperture. And then on the camera, I always would experiment a little bit with the ISO settings. I would start around 1600 to 3200 in ISO and see if that is too noisy for that exposure, or if you're not experiencing noise, you can even push it further. Is that a kind of the settings that you might use, Mike?
It is, and I would add that focus is just so important to check and recheck. And I've done time lapses and shot for hours, and I look at the preview image in the LCD panel, and it looks good, and I shoot, and then I get to the end of the night, and I discover that I never had focus. And the trick there is that when you just look at the full image on the LCD, it is so small that out of focus stars will appear to be in focus. And so you really have to use the zoom function of the review to look at one-to-one actual size and make sure that your stars are truly pinpoints and not fuzzy blobs. Because in the overview mode, fuzzy blobs are going to look like pinpoints. And so, almost to the point of, if you're manually shooting, you're not doing a time lapse, you probably want to check that focus after every shot, just hitting the zoom button to view at the one-to-one or every few shots. It's especially with lenses that are not manual lenses, you put it into manual focus and it's often very, very easy to inadvertently, you're readjusting your framing and you've bumped the focus ring without noticing it. And now you're out of focus and you're not going to see that in the auto review unless you zoom in. So.
Yeah. And that's a great, beginner tip. And I think, like more advanced, users might be going to a manual type lens, but on my manual lenses, I actually tape them down at the with my perfect quote unquote infinity focus. Is I actually tape that lens up so that it will always stay at that particular focus. And that may change a little bit with temperature and stuff like that, but in general, that works as a kind of a trick for manual lenses. And for the automatic lenses or autofocus lenses, even in manual mode, like you said, it's super easy to bump that. And so it is, like you said, very important to double check your focus. And then I also kind of, preset it, even when it's light out, as I'll find the very furthest object that I can possibly focus on, basically at least get it in the ballpark as far as what infinity focus would be, by adjusting that lens.
Yeah, by the way, Jay, I did take a look on eBay just to see what that Rebel T5 is going for used. And yeah, you can get a camera with a suitable lens in the $150 range. Some of the used body only run as low as $115. So then you find a good wide lens for a manual lens. Fine for your very first shoots, but I usually find that I want to replace the kit lens with the fixed manual lens pretty quickly. And so, to buy a body only for $115 and then probably, another $100 or $50 for a good, f/2.8 18mm manual for, used 50 to 100 is that's probably, $200, and you've got a really nice beginner kit.
Yeah, and you probably will have to add an intervalometer onto that, and those of course go for $20 to $30, and I think that the T5 does not have a built-in time lapse mode if you want to do time lapse photography, and so if you. We could talk a little bit about interferometers really quickly. Is that an interferometer is just basically it triggers your camera, it plugs into the camera, and it triggers the camera to do an exposure every so often. And so on your camera, there's usually in manual where it can set what's called a bulb mode. And the bulb mode basically says that whenever the camera is triggered, it will stay open for as long as the trigger is open. And so the intervalometer works on if you set, for example, a 30-second exposure on your intervalometer, it will, trigger the camera to open the shutter and hold that shutter open for that 30 seconds if the camera is in bulb mode. And then it will release the shutter 30 seconds, after that 30 seconds, and then the camera will take an exposure. And you actually use an external intervalometer, even though on your Sonys, even though they do have a built-in time-lapse mode, is that right?
I have externals, but these days, just for the simplicity and the fewer things that can go wrong, I'm using the built-in. Now, I have bought a MIOPS, that's MIOPS, that it's supposed to do bulb ramping so I can get smooth sunrise sunset transitions. I haven't quite gotten that nailed down, but I just picked that up a week ago. It's an interesting little device, $230. It does storm lapses, so it has a lightning detection mode, but you can put it into a time lapse mode and then it'll shoot at your interval. Plus, if it detects by infrared flash that there's going to be a lightning burst, it'll take extra pictures to capture the lightning so that you're only taking it every 4 seconds. You don't miss the lightning bolts that happen in between those 4 seconds. It's got some other features. So I've been playing around with that external device, and it just connects with the cable. It mounts in the flash hot shoe. And but like I say, that's, the battery on that can go. It can run out of exposures in the middle of my time lapse. That hasn't happened yet, but it's one extra complication. So I did not like the Sony Play Store time lapse application, and I found an open source project that built their own, which is more flexible and has worked very well for me. I'm really happy with it.
Uh-huh. And so, yeah, that's kind of getting a little bit out of kind of the beginner category. But as this hobby is addictive, is that once you get your first good Milky Way photograph or meteor photograph, it's hard to not become obsessed. Go ahead.
That is how you're going to get your meteor photographs. And the odds of I'm just going to go out and take, 20 pictures tonight, my odds of actually capturing a meteor are probably under 1%, probably under a tenth of a percent. But if I go out and I set up my camera with an intervalometer and I take photos from sunset to sunrise, if a meteor comes through the field of view, I'm almost certain to get it because I'm going to take currently 10-second exposures with less than a second between exposures. So, you know, in a minute, there's six exposures, and out of that 60 seconds, I am probably capturing 58 seconds of starlight. So total. So, you know, almost every single meteor is going to appear in my time lapse, and then I've got the still photos that I can pull out and enjoy.
Yeah, that's true. And then, of course, the other nice thing about shooting time lapses is once you get them set up and you get the thing cranking, is then you can go to bed. So, you don't have to stay up all night doing astrophotography, which is, you know, when you get to be older like me, is you know, you kind of have that nine to 10 o'clock bedtime that puts a dent in your astrophotography for sure. And of course I was out shooting a time lapse last night, and I went out there this morning to recover the camera. And the way that my camera works is, to stop the time lapse is you actually switch the camera to off. And so I went to switch the camera to off, and the on and off lever on the camera broke off. So now I've got my primary camera is basically inoperable. So I'm a little disappointed with that this morning. And then one last thing I wanted to kind of mention really quickly. We also mentioned this in your kind of our low budget astrophotography segment a couple episodes ago, is that there's these new SMART telescopes that are in the under $500 range, or the near $500 range, like the S30 telescope from ZWO. And that is a telescope that has a wide angle lens as well as a telescope lens, and you can actually do, you know, time lapses. You can do, you know, long exposure astrophotography and stuff like that. And so that's another thing. If you were just want to be really dedicated toward astrophotography, and you can take a look at some of these new SMART telescopes that are out there.
Yeah, that's right. I really enjoy my C-Star S50, and it's great for not only nighttime astrophotography, but for solar photography as well, using the included filter.
That's right. And you can, a lot of people think that astrophotography is a nighttime pursuit, but, you know, actually catching the sun and sunspots moving across the face, and things like I had the Venus transit a couple of years ago that I captured with that telescope, and that was very gratifying. And of course, there's the solar eclipses that you can capture with that. So that's kind of how a beginner can get started with astrophotography, and we hope those tips have helped you out. And we want you to encourage you to be sure to comment, like, and subscribe, and let us know how we did and what you'd like to hear more about or less about. And you can also check out our individual websites at wildernessvagabonds.com, and that's Mike's site, and mine is skylapser.com. And I actually have a tutorial on that site for doing all-sky time lapses. And so that might be helpful for you as well. And if you'd like to help us out, you can, so we can fix our cameras, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/skylapser. The intro music is Fanfare for Space by Kevin MacLeod from the YouTube Audio Library. And from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory, this is Jay Schaefer and
Mike Lewinsky
wishing you all clear skies.